Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Steve Paulson in for Jim Fleming. I'll tell you, listening to that music brings back memories. Monday Night Football, Howard Cosell. I grew up with football. And since I grew up in Wisconsin, I was a Green Bay Packers fan. I'm still a huge Packers fan, which makes this Super Bowl kind of bittersweet. I thought the Packers might make it to the big game. But hey, it's the Super Bowl, and I'm excited. It should be a great game. Which brings us to our first interview with Alan St. John. He wrote The Billion Dollar Game, behind the scenes of the greatest day in American sport, Super Bowl Sunday. Jim Fleming asked him, when did football become more than a game?
I think it's been sort of, you know, a gradual evolution. I think that there have been just different things that sort of pushed the game into being something much more than a game. I mean, the first thing, though, of course, was the fact that, and it was really kind of a coincidence in a way, and a kind, and not something that was really planned out, but this idea that you make the Super Bowl a giant sort of, it's a neutral site event, and two, it's a site where you have a date well in advance, and so you can plan things around that. Whereas you look at almost any other championship game, in certainly in professional sports, you don't have that. You don't know where the World Series is going to be played. You don't know when it's going to start. You don't know when the NBA Finals are going to start. You don't know when the Stanley Cup Finals are going to start. And you don't know where any of those things are going to be. So it's really hard to sort of do anything that's planned in advance. And the Super Bowl, on the other hand, you know, we know where the Super Bowls are going to be and when they're going to be, you know, going out for, you know, 4 or 5 years. And that's one of the reasons that they're able to make it into such a big spectacle and a big holiday, really.
Yeah, that explains almost more than anything else. Of course, we've been talking about outside the game of football now. We should get a little closer to inside. You had the opportunity to go inside Fox Sports as they planned the Super Bowl 42. What was it like there? What challenges did they face as they began planning this broadcast?
Well, I think it's really interesting because, I mean, these guys had a guy named Artie Kempner, who's the director for Fox Sports, and a guy named Richie Zients, who's the producer. And basically, they knew that they were going to be doing the Super Bowl. You know, Fox basically, and as do all the networks, sort of keep teams together, the technical teams and then also the broadcast teams, you know, and they know that the Joe Buck and Troy Aikman team is going to be the number one team. They're going to do the Super Bowl. So they knew this coming in, and they've done a Super Bowl once before. And the thing is, though, you know, these guys, you know, are very much students of the game. I mean, they watch old game tapes the same way that people watch games, but they're looking at the coverage. And one of the things that they would tell me is they look at these games, and they were clearly these guys who they respected tremendously and who had done, you know, and who were really, you know, the very best, you know, that particular network had to offer at any given point. And yet the games were often sort of underwhelming from a technical point of view. They were kind of choppy. They just didn't have a flow and a rhythm. And then what they sort of figured out was that, again, in this idea of Super Bowl sort of growing from more to more, it was like, well, you know, if 12 cameras is good, then 17 cameras is better, and 24 cameras is even better, and how about 30? And at a certain point, you could just, you know, when you're doing the Super Bowl, you have some budget, and you can just sort of throw resources at it. The problem, of course, is that unlike, let's say, a film set, where, you know, if it doesn't work, well, you get take two, or you get take 27, you know, in a Super Bowl, you don't get that. What you get is you've got literally a matter of seconds to find the right replay, to find the right monitors and all of that. And the thing is, they, you know, they would get to the point where they would just literally not know where to look at any given point because they were essentially trying to sort of play a different game in the Super Bowl than they did all year long. And that's, and Artie and Richie were saying, we're really going to try not to do that. And we're going to really resist that impulse. And it was something, it was kind of a theme all the way throughout the season. And they had, you know, and there were a few bumps along the road, a few beautiful games that had one glaring mistake and that sort of thing. And they were sort of, you know, just hoping that sort of thing didn't come back to bite them in the Super Bowl.
Well, and this game, they had the Giants and the Patriots' perfect season and the upstart Giants there, and there were some plays where they must have been glad they had the 30 cameras, I guess, and the 30 times however many people to know where the footage was from those 30 cameras.
Well, actually, what they did is really they didn't go with the 30 cameras. They added a couple of extra cameras and a few extra people to basically just, you know, if we need them and sort of keep them at, you know, keep them off to the side. And they basically went with a real sort of straightforward, kind of layout, and it worked beautifully. There was a, you know, I think one little moment where they were on the David Tyree catch. They're like, where is it?
And this is the Eli Manning's.
This is exactly. It was Eli Manning's pass to David Tyree with only a few seconds left in the game. It was a huge, crucial, you know, it was the signature play, not only of the game, but maybe of the Super Bowl in general. It was one of the greatest plays ever. And for a second, they weren't sure that they had the replay. But then if you actually go back and you look at it, the actual play, the first replay that they have, it's just absolutely poetic. You see, this is a play where Eli Manning is getting all sorts of pressure. And I was talking again to Joe Buck, who was the announcer, and he was saying, in my head, I had this, the words were already there. They just hadn't quite gotten to my mouth.
And the words were?
And the words were, and Eli Manning is sacked. And he didn't say that. And he, you could hear him, he says Eli Manning, and he's about to say it and waiting basically for Manning to go down.
Pressure from Thomas off the edge. Eli Manning stays on his feet.
And there was just that little bit of hesitation, but he could see that it was going to happen. And yet somehow or another, like, you know, a grape, he just sort of squirted out of the pile, rolled to his right, found Tyree. Tyree jumps up, catches the ball up against his helmet, and makes the catch.
And Eli, man, I don't know how he got out of there. I thought he was on the ground, and then he came out of the pile and just slings it.
And again, they had just this absolutely beautiful, poetic shot of this. And it was about, you know, again, it's they didn't, it was a matter of,
well, there were so many times when that could have gone wrong. I mean, you think about Joe Buck almost saying something that would have had him the butt of jokes for years to come. And but then you think about the camera too. They had absolutely every reason to sit back on their heels as they watched Manning go down, but instead somebody was watching Tyree.
Well, that's exactly the point, though. I mean, you know, and again, this was sort of the payoff for a year's worth of one just banging it into the heads of all these camera guys. And because all the guys, to get onto the Fox A team, you've got to be very, very good. The problem, of course, is that some of the guys who are very, very good are sort of trying to sort of make up for the mistakes of guys who are maybe not quite as good when they've worked on teams with where they were clearly the best guy. Well, these guys, everybody's very good. And what Artie Kempner would be banging into their heads every single time is you have to stay with your assignment. You can't sort of get just go after the ball. You can't go after a certain player. You just have to do what your job is and expect that everybody else is going to do it. And then sometimes also be called upon on these just when you'd least expect it to show, you know, on a play where the ball doesn't come to you in order to show something else about the way the game is developing and about what's going on away from the ball. And in this one particular shot and this one particular replay and really that last drive of the game, that just showed that, you know, that was the culmination of just a full season of just of discipline of people saying, here, this is how we're going to do it this way, and we're going to stick to the program, and that's what we're going to do.
You talk about Joe Buck and Troy Aikman and what they didn't say and what they almost said and what they did say, but there's a kind of famous moment at the end when it was what they didn't say that was really the story, wasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it came, you know, finally when Plaxico Burress, who had, you know, a very, very expensive gunshot during the season this year. Well, when Plaxico Burress was the star of that Super Bowl and made that really remarkable catch.
Burress alone, touchdown, New York.
Joe Buck just said nothing. He just let it play out. Had this beautiful montage of the different players, of the people in the stands, of people on the sidelines, and just really sort of let the moment be there and didn't stomp over it. And for really a shockingly long time, it's like it's over a minute where there's just nothing but, you know, live audio, but no commentary. There's basically sort of nothing to say in that moment, and they were smart enough to not say it.
Alan St. John is the author of The Billion Dollar Game, behind the scenes of the greatest day in American sport, Super Bowl Sunday. Jim Fleming talked with him.
Third and goal, split back. Sean gets it going left. He gets outside. Touchdown, Seahawks. And hand number 37, the record, Sean Alexander, with 28 touchdowns this season. He's not done yet, but his name goes into the NFL record books. Congratulations, Sean.
That's Sean Alexander during his magic year. He was the MVP and led his team to the Super Bowl. And it turns out he wasn't just a great football player. He loves the game of chess. We're digging into our archives this hour. I interviewed Sean the year after he won his MVP award.
I think the biggest thing was the feel of it. Like, I started to think down the road, and, like, I noticed, like, well, wait a minute. Like, and I started making everything almost like the chessboard, like how I play the football game. Well, if I take two steps this way, I can get the safety to move here. I can get the linebacker to move here. I can come back here, and it's going to work, you know. With family, okay, if I make this decision with my wife, then the kids will act like this, and we'll move like this, and this would be success. I like that chess set a good thinking pattern for life.
So there really are some similarities, I guess, between chess and football. I mean, it really is about conquering the opposition, and it has to do with, there was a lot of strategy involved in moving around all the different pieces on the playing field.
Totally. Like, when people get with me and they're like, gosh, you know, you look like you just set up every running play that you have on a football field. And I'm like, yeah, you know, they're 100% correct. Everything I do is to set up something for later on in the game.
Well, do you think chess actually helps you as a running back in the NFL?
I think so. I think it just helped me in a way of thinking, because, you know, I was only 14 years old when I first started understanding the strategy of the game. So it started making me understand that there's a thought process. There's a reaction to every action. There's things that you can do to move other things to what you want to accomplish. So, you know, for life, for football, definitely, you know, talent, of course, helps, but it definitely went well for me, you know, playing chess, you know, at that age for those couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that Kansas City Chiefs running back Priest Holmes, whose touchdown record you broke last year, is also a chess player. Have you ever played him?
No, I haven't played against none of the running backs except some of the Seahawks. You know, it's really funny because in the running back world, there's a handful of us that play chess.
And a lot of great players. I mean, I've heard Jim Brown and Barry Sanders and Curtis Martin all play chess.
Yep, Jim, Curtis, Barry, Priest, me. Yeah, it is wild, but there's something that, and it's funny because we're the running backs, you know. So, like, there's a thought process that goes into our game. Like, you know, it's like Muhammad Ali for boxing. He used to always say, you know, he loved playing against those guys that would just come in and just throwing punches all wild, because after a while, physically, they wouldn't be able to hold up, you know, so he was like the smart boxer. Well, if you look at the best football players, we play the game and we're physically gifted, but there's something mentally that we have this advantage over just about most defenses that we play against. It's because we've thought out the process that no matter how strong or how fast you are, if you move here, we can move here and we'll win.
That's Sean Alexander, the NFL's most valuable player in 2005. He's now retired, but he still plays chess. And through the nonprofit group America's Foundation for Chess, Alexander sponsors in-school chess programs for inner-city elementary schools. Now, speaking of kids, we have another piece from our archives. Here are some students from Mrs. Mintzberg's fourth-grade class at Randall Elementary School, just down the street from us in Madison. They're reading the poem, The King.
I am the king of chess, the most important piece of all. I have a cross atop my crown that makes me extra tall.
Being the king is fun, and being the king is grand, because all the other pieces are at my command.
I'll send a knight out galloping, or a rook along a file, or a bishop down a diagonal to stay for a little while.
So I move the pieces all around.
And I really think it's fair.
Because I am a grand old king,
but I only move one square.
I'm Steve Paulson, in for Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. I really love football. But if I'm honest, I have to admit it's a guilty pleasure. This is a violent game. And that's never been so clear as it is now. I mean, think of all the stories about concussions, the retired players who have suffered from permanent brain damage. And of course, the most tragic thing of all, the suicides of some former players, like Junior Seau. So if you're a fan of football, is there any way to make sense of all the violence? It's not easy, but it's something we've been talking about as we were putting together this show, and it brought to mind an interview Jim Fleming did a while ago with Michael Mandelbaum. Now, he's actually a foreign policy expert, a former policy advisor to Bill Clinton, and he sees a lot of parallels between football and warfare.
They both have to do with violence, but violence for a purpose. Both are about controlling territory. Both are hierarchical. The coach corresponds to the general, the field commander. In each case, the combatants each has a particular role to play that he carries out, but the overall design resides in the mind of a person who does not take part in combat. The vernacular of football, the long bomb, the blitz, is borrowed from war. And it's worth noting, both of them are dangerous. You can get hurt playing football just as you can get hurt engaging in battle.
Yeah, and you've got, I suppose, some other similarities. The long bomb you were talking about is, I think you said in the book that it's like the artillery. The running back is like the cavalry. Yeah, you do have some metaphors that are drawn straight out of experience with war.
And to complete the trio there, the linemen are like infantry. The so-called grunts are like the men who expose themselves to the greatest violence and who are responsible for capturing territory and have been in war since the time of the ancient Greeks. So I say in The Meaning of Sports that somebody not familiar with football but familiar with the way militaries are organized would recognize a powerful correspondence there.
Can you tell me about the ways that sports have replaced religion in modern society?
The first chapter of The Meaning of Sports is called A Variety of Religious Experience, and I detail in that chapter the ways in which team sports in general fill some of the needs that in pre-modern times were filled by religion. Sports give us heroes, role models that correspond in some ways, although of course not in all ways, to religious saints. Sports give us rituals. Sports even give us holidays. Super Bowl Sunday has become a kind of secular holiday where everybody pays attention to what's going on, where there are lots of social gatherings. In fact, the Super Bowl now outstrips New Year's Eve as the principal occasion for parties in the United States. So in these and in other ways, there is a real religious or quasi-religious aspect to our three favorite team sports in general.
What does it say, do you think, about the American psyche that the sport we've chosen to honor most now, football, has so much in common with war?
It's a very good question, and I speculate a bit about that in The Meaning of Sports. Indeed, I wonder whether football, because violence is at its core and because we increasingly disapprove of violence, may come to be less and less popular as the 21st century wears on. I wonder whether it may someday go the way of smoking as a custom, a habit, a ritual that once was regarded as normal, natural, and admirable, but now seems unsafe. But at the same time, I think it has to be said that even in an era, that is the present moment, when we are far more disapproving of war than we ever were before in our history, there is an appeal for violence. Violence has always drawn spectators, going all the way back to the public hangings in Great Britain in the 17th and 18th centuries. In fact, some have even speculated that violence is hardwired into our genes as something necessary for survival on the savannah where Homo sapiens began. And if that's true, and of course we don't know whether it's true, but to the extent that it is true, there may be something almost genetic about the appeal of football, combined with the fact that while football does have at its core violence, it's controlled violence. It's non-lethal violence. So it may be a way of domesticating something that's both fascinating and inevitable and making it palatable in our 21st century American society.
Of course, the Super Bowl is going to be viewed on television all over the world now. Is it a fair representation of America? Can it explain America in ways that we like and don't like to the rest of the world?
Well, it certainly represents one part of America, the love of spectacle, of great occasions, of colorful characters. It also, as I point out in the book, emphasizes a particular kind of authority because the most important person on any football team, because of the way that football is structured, is the coach. But it's also true that our brand of football really isn't played in any other country in the world. In fact, in most countries in the world, of course, football means soccer. So the Super Bowl does exhibit part of what is distinctive and different about the United States, and it also exhibits something that a lot of people don't like about the United States, that is their view that we have a higher propensity for violence than other countries. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think it is fair to say that that is one impression that global viewers of the Super Bowl might come away with.
Michael Mandelbaum was a foreign policy advisor to Bill Clinton. His book is called The Meaning of Sports: Why Americans Watch Baseball, Football, and Basketball, and What They See When They Do.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
Comedian George Carlin also had a few things to say about football and warfare, especially when you compare it to baseball.
Baseball is a 19th century pastoral game. Football is a 20th century technological struggle. Baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, sometimes called Soldier Field or War Memorial Stadium. Baseball begins in the spring, the season of new life. Football begins in the fall when everything is dying. In football, you wear a helmet.
In baseball, you wear a cap.
Football is concerned with downs. What down is it?
Baseball is concerned with ups. Who's up? Are you up? I'm not up. He's up.
In football, the specialist comes in to kick.
In baseball, the specialist comes in to relieve someone.
In football, you receive a penalty.
In baseball, you make an error.
Whoops! Football has hitting, clipping, spearing, blocking, piling on, late hitting, unnecessary roughness, and personal fouls.
Baseball has the sacrifice.
Football is played in any kind of weather. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, mud. Can't read the numbers on the field, can't read the yard markers, can't read the players' numbers. The struggle will continue.
In baseball, if it rains, we don't come out to play. I can't come out to play. It's raining out.
Baseball has a seventh inning stretch. Football has the 2-minute warning.
Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings.
Football is rigidly timed, and it will end even if we have to go to sudden death.
In baseball, during the game in the stands, there's kind of a picnic feeling. Emotions may run high or low, but there's not that much unpleasantness.
In football, in the stands during the game, you can be sure that at least 27 times you are perfectly capable of taking the life of a fellow human being. Preferably a stranger. And finally, the objectives of the two games are totally different. In football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy, in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. In baseball, the object is to go home and to be safe. I hope I'll be safe at home.
That's comedian George Carlin. This hour, we're talking about football and the Super Bowl. Of course, not everyone's a fan, including our own Ann Strangchamps, who is right here in the studio with me. So I have to ask, Ann,
Are you going to watch the game?
No, I will not be watching fat men chase each other down a big green field. I will be joining all the other football agnostics at the shopping mall or the grocery store. As a working mom, I have always found Super Bowl Sunday to be a great time to get errands done, frankly, because the stores and streets are pretty empty. But while we're on the subject of Super Bowl, there actually is one thing I've always wondered. Why is it Super Bowl Sunday? I mean, why isn't it Super Bowl Saturday? Saturday's a fun day. You know, it's a play day, right? You could see the game in the afternoon and you could party all night if you wanted to. But Sunday, I mean, Sunday's got a whole different vibe. You've got to get up and go to work the next day. Actually, the history of Sunday turns out to be pretty interesting. Historian Craig Harline wrote an entire book about it and says it wasn't always the day of rest.
After about 400, Sunday became a full day free from work. And therefore, there began to be discussion over what should be done the rest of the day, thus outside of worship. That's when Sunday began to take on this more Sabbath-like character. Christians debated, what is the nature of Sunday? Should it be like the Jewish Sabbath? Should it have different rules from the Jewish Sabbath, but the same spirit, essentially? And that's when it really began. And during the Middle Ages, that tendency toward the creation of what Christians called a sort of Christian Sabbath continued. The Puritans in the 16th and 17th century in England and in the Americas solidified that tradition, and they called Sunday the Sabbath. They didn't say it was merely a sort of Sabbath or a figurative Sabbath. It was the Sabbath, true and proper. It had been reinstituted by God on the new day of the week and so on. And so, therefore, the religious elements of Sunday have been there a long time.
So you've done a kind of interesting thing in this book. Rather than just kind of march through the history, you've sort of singled out Sundays in different historical periods and sort of done a vignette, a profile of how the day might have been celebrated by some typical people. So let's take a look at some of those. For instance, medieval Catholic England. How did a typical person, how would you or I have experienced Sunday if we were living then?
Right. I noted that there, I thought, would be four themes. Working, a better meal than usual, church, and a lot of fun. And the working is a little bit surprising because by the Middle Ages, it was pretty clear that Christians were not supposed to work on Sunday. It had taken on the character of a rest day, just like the Jewish Sabbath. But because almost everyone was a farmer or peasant of some kind, there were things that have to be done every day of the week, as farmers today know as well. So during the summer months, at least, Sunday would often include a bit of work. But that would be followed by church. We don't know exactly how many people attended church, but everyone belonged to the church. They were baptized into it and born into it.
What did people do for fun in medieval England?
Well, they played games, not necessarily the same games we would. There was an early form of football already by this time, but there was archery and so forth. But mostly they went to taverns and socialized. I think that was one of the big purposes of Sunday. That was the day when you would especially see a lot of people and you could relax.
Huh. Was there much of a conflict even back then about how people used Sunday? I mean, did some church leaders think that people shouldn't go to the tavern and drink and people should just stay home and worship?
Yeah, the tension began again after about 500 when the church began to give Sunday a series of rules. These are things you should and shouldn't do on Sunday. And so, yes, there was always a sort of tension. But people ended up pretty much doing what they wanted to do, I think.
You know the Little House on the Prairie books?
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading one of those, and the description of a Sunday was so different than it is now. I just remember the children were supposed to sit still, and they were supposed to spend the whole day reading scripture, and I think somebody got whipped because they went out sledding when they weren't supposed to. When did that kind of Sunday appear?
That's definitely from the English and Puritan tradition, and that was an important tradition in the Americas as well. Of course, a lot of the first settlers came to New England. But settlers who came along the rest of the eastern seaboard generally did not insist on such a strict Sunday as that. So in the Americas, you had both traditions, but that English Puritan tradition was very strong. And typically, the insistence on a strict Sunday comes from that tradition.
Hmm. Now, there's another kind of Sunday, a whole different Sunday tradition that you focus on. Maybe we could fast forward to 19th century France, because that's a very different sort of Sunday, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it also includes some of the elements that we've seen earlier in history or earlier in the book. That is, there's certainly opportunity for church and so on. But by now, there are a lot of other things going on Sunday as well. Not everyone has to belong to a church anymore. So they also enjoy their day off, which is Sunday. So the Sunday in France, which to me was the most famous Sunday ever, with the famous painting by Seurat and all the cafe scenes and all the depictions of Sunday scenes in novels and short stories. This is the Sunday that everybody held up as the thing to love or as the thing to hate. Now, most people loved it, but again, it was the English Puritan tradition that didn't like the French model. They regarded it as licentious and so on. And if you compare it to an English Sunday, in fact, there was a lot more going on in France.
What kind of Sunday was it? What did people do?
Well, it could include church, but it certainly included opportunities to go to cafes, restaurants. Restaurant was a new invention, a big invention in the late 19th century. It included lots of parks that were available in France, pleasure trains to the ocean, if you lived in Paris, for instance. Walking down the boulevard would often offer entertainment enough because people went out to be seen and to see other people, so the famous promenade of the French Sunday. So there are a lot of park scenes, a lot of cafe scenes, a lot of things going on outdoors.
So Sunday was really a play day.
Well, it was, but you could say that that was true in the Middle Ages as well, that there's always this element of holy day and holiday. Those have come to mean two opposite things in modern English, but in the Middle Ages, they meant exactly the same thing. And it's probably not bad to think about that, to think that a holy day usually includes holiday sorts of things, and a holiday might include holy day sorts of things. So, in other words, the two terms go together.
So how do you see these two strands playing out today in modern-day America in the Sunday that we've evolved?
Well, you can see the Puritan strain still, and you can see the continental European strain still. The Puritan strain is still alive in certain religious denominations. Certainly, you can see that all the high activity of a Sunday, the sporting events and so forth, that definitely comes from the continental European traditions. And they kind of fuse into something distinctly American. In fact, the tendency to have a lot of sporting activities on Sunday is more American than it is either European or English.
Has writing this book changed anything about the way you approach your Sundays?
Now that I'm an old guy, maybe not. If I had been a kid, I probably would have played more. But as an old guy, I don't mind resting on Sunday anymore. I think it's certainly, if you come from kind of the stricter English tradition, it maybe helps you re-envision Sunday, that there are more possibilities than you imagine, and that the English tradition is just one alternative.
So the subtext of your book could be getting rid of Sunday guilt?
I suppose it could be that. Or just re-envisioning it for yourself, you know, how you want to make it a more creative Sunday.
I have to confess, Sunday is probably my least favorite day of the week. And over the years, I mean, there's a particular kind of dread and sort of feeling in the pit of my stomach, Sunday afternoons especially, you know, the weekend's coming to an end and you really have to start kind of thinking about work again. I used to think that was just me, and over the years I've come to realize that a lot of people have that kind of Sunday dread, and it does kind of color my perception of the whole day. Did you find that that's true of a lot of people?
Well, I didn't go and do interviews or make a systematic study, but that was the impression I got. And that, in fact, one psychologist coined a term called Sunday neurosis. I thought about that, and I thought, well, there could be at least two kinds of Sunday neuroses. The first kind that he meant was the kind that dreads Sunday's coming because it means an end to the routine of the week. And when routine stops, you have to stop and think about things. You might even have to question your routine. You might have to ask the big questions, like, what am I doing? What's the purpose of all this? The routine sometimes distracts you from all the big questions of life. So some people don't like that seizing of the routine. I think the kind that you're talking about is more in the French model, and that is, you like Sunday so much that you can't stand to see it go. You're just dreading Monday coming again, and when you have to go out of this kind of timeless existence that might emerge, at least briefly, on Sunday.
Well, you know, I think doctors tell us that most heart attacks happen Monday mornings, so evidently a lot of people feel that way.
Maybe other people feel the same way. But then there are people who can't wait to get back to work. That's why I found that bumper sticker humorous, which said, thank God it's Monday. Because, of course, before it was always, thank God it's Friday. But this time, thank God it's Monday. They're so glad that the lack of routine of Sunday is past.
Craig Harline wrote the history of Sunday, from Babylonia to the Super Bowl. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
If you really think about it, being a sports fan is really pretty weird. I say this as a huge Packers fan. When they went to the Super Bowl a few years ago, I started having dreams about the Packers. And watching the Packers, especially during a big game, it's the only time I ever yell at the TV, which I have to say annoys the rest of my family. But they aren't Packers fans. They don't get it. I think the theologian William Dean would understand. He wrote a book called The American Spiritual Culture and the Invention of Jazz, Football, and the Movies. Jim Fleming talked with him about the genius of both football and jazz.
Americans, unlike most other peoples, are comprised of people that have been uprooted and thrown into a wilderness where there is not a long set of traditions that they can recognize as their own. This happened even to the American Indian, who was uprooted from his or her society, and to the African American. But all Americans are, in one sense or another, immigrants, even if they're still occupying the land in which their ancestors lived. And this requires Americans, finally, to be in a position where if they're to have a culture, they have to invent one. They have to improvise one. I moved to jazz because jazz is really, more than anything else, music that is played without a composition, without a long heritage that's given to it on a piece of paper. The genius of jazz is that the players improvise as they go. And it's interesting to me that in America, jazz was born.
You write about John Coltrane, in fact, who was known for improvisation, the great jazz sax player.
I take jazz very seriously. It's not simply a form of entertainment, but it is a form of searching. It's an act of expression that finally is an act that attempts to penetrate the surfaces of the society, to find some answer to the blues, to find some way of coping with the confusions and the dissonances we experience. So yes, I do cite John Coltrane as a perfect example, someone who took improvisation to the heights of, some people thought, making it for its own sake. And near the end of his life, he said, "It's not for its own sake. This is an improvisation that becomes a nullification of music that finally gets at something greater than music."
Talking about John Coltrane, I think I understand what you're talking about. I wonder, though, can you give me an example? If you were to listen, can you hear him search for truth?
If truth really is a recognition that we, at some point or another, have the slate swept clean, that we lose faith in any typical sense of the word, that we experience a kind of everyday atheism where simply the sound of music pretends to be sufficient, I think I can hear that, and I think I can hear him break through that to a grounds for new affirmation. When jazz swings, when it seems to celebrate, when it seems to discover some basis for affirmation, I think I can hear him searching.
Well, along those lines, you've also suggested that maybe one of the most religious areas in American life is football. Now, that seems to be a contradiction.
Yes, it does. I've told the American story in three episodes that we leave some mother country where there was a prevailing set of deep and lasting traditions. And we have occupied as a people what seems like, to us at least, a wilderness. It may not seem that way to the Indians, but to the majority, it seemed like a wilderness. And that we had somehow to gain that land through our own rough and ready acts of assertion. And it seems to me that in one sense or another, football is a ritualization of the taking of land violently.
Fumble ball.
Pick it up.
Down the sidelines. Newsom.
He's gone.
To the 10, to the 5. Touchdown, Green Bay.
Derek Lavelle with the fumble. Newsom picks it up. And the rookie has scored the touchdown for the Packers.
I'll
what a play.
You, what a hit. I'm not sure who hit him, Jim.
Wayne Simmons
just.
So where is the spirituality
loose
in that?
Out of that sort of atheism of the sheer exertion of force, we find grounds for new affirmation in what I'd like to call the third episode of American experience, which is the invention of a culture, the invention of a spiritual tradition.
The violence is not itself spiritual. It is part of the search for spirituality?
That's exactly right. It's a recognition that we are alone, that we have been divested of culture, that we have entered a land without culture, that we tend to rely on just naked aggression as a way of identifying ourselves. But no, in itself, that has no very positive spiritual element, but it is a perfect way, I think, of recognizing that we are attempting to acquire the grounds on which spiritual definition will occur.
we can also find depth where we see only superficiality.
That's right. One of the motifs for my book is what I call the irony of atheism, that the radically secular culture that America is finally has the ironic consequence of leading people to an utter switch. They find out of this naked atheistic secularism new grounds for spiritual affirmation.
That's theologian William Dean. His book is The American Spiritual Culture and the Invention of Jazz, Football, and the Movies.
You got two more quarters, and after that, most of you will never play this game again as long as you live. I want you to take a moment, and I want you to look each other in the eyes. I want you to put each other in your hearts forever, because forever is about to happen here in just a few minutes.
Hi, I'm Charles Monroe Kane. I'm the producer of this hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge. I grew up in northeastern Ohio, where Massillon, Ohio is. Massillon, Ohio is the birthplace of football. And if you're from where I'm from, you live, eat, and breathe football. So if you're a young man like me, you play it. I played my junior year. I was defensive back. I never got off the practice squad. Fast forward 25-odd years, and I wonder what all the fuss is about from back in high school. Kenneth Carlson thought the same thing. He's from Massillon, Ohio. He was a Tiger in high school. When he went back with a camera and made a documentary film called Go Tigers. Ann Strainchamps was intrigued, and she talked to him about it.
This is this year's Booster Club president, Todd Schumacher.
Nice to meet you, Barbara.
Congratulations. I understand that you have a new Tiger here.
Mm-hmm. Name's Drew.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
This is a football from the Booster Club we give out to all the newborn boys born in Massillon. Mm-hmm.
Pedro went off, and I rushed over to the Massillon Community Hospital, where I met the president of the Booster Club and his sidekick. And we marched into a newborn baby boy's room, and there the mother sat wide-eyed, and we presented a football to her. They did. And I captured this on tape, and they presented her with a football and welcomed her son into the new world and said, my, he'd be a fine receiver, and we're looking forward to him playing for the Tigers in the near future.
Does this really happen with every baby boy born in Massillon?
It does, and I did not stage that. I literally was on pager, and I raced over when the pager went off, and this is what happens. They have a box of footballs in the hospital, and they race over and put all this together to welcome a newborn baby boy.
So when you grow up, is football pretty much the only sport? I mean, do little boys 6, 7, 9, 10, 12, do they all play football?
This is the shortest answer I'll give, yes. They are expected to play, and when you don't play, I think I showed in the film, you're considered an outcast. Now, certainly we've broadened our horizons a bit there in Massillon, Ohio, and not everyone is expected to play because we're a little more hip to what other kids might want. And, you know, in this day and age of the internet and video games, people aren't expected to play as much, but that's what it was when I grew up there. And pretty much is the way it is today.
You're completely ostracized from all of your peers if you're not part of the football unless they share your views. People aren't willing to accept you unless you're like them. You have to conform or be destroyed. I'm out of here when I turn 18. This town is bullcrap. It's just sad.
It is sort of extraordinary watching your film to see how much the adults in this town care about football and how much football is completely wound into every part of public life. I mean, there's a scene, I'm thinking of the scene in the funeral parlor, for instance, when the funeral parlor director shows that they've even got a Tiger's casket.
Sure. I mean, that's the cradle-to-grave concept. You know, you're born in Massillon with a football in your bassinet, and you have an opportunity when you die to be laid to rest in a casket that has Paul Brown on it, Obie the Tiger, the mascot. You know, you can be laid to rest in orange and black jersey or a tie, you know, and a blazer, and your headstone can have Obie on it or the years that you played. And they've got a whole, you know, that funeral home itself has a Tiger room. And you walk into this, the calling hours room where people are, you know, grieving their loved ones passing on. And you hear in the background the Tiger fight song, Tiger Rag. And that is from a welcome mat. When you walk into this Tiger room, it plays, you know, and you can literally go in and look through files and find out if you are or your loved one was related to a Tiger. And there's Tiger orange everywhere in this funeral home, in this room. So it's,
We have this
casket customized, making it the Massillon Tiger casket with the OVs all the way around on all of the hardware. It's painted the Massillon Tiger colors. And also in the panel, this is an insert panel of Obi. Okay, this is Obi, which is the mascot for Massillon. The panel can come out. When the person is buried, it can be framed and kept at home as a keepsake.
Tell me about the year you followed the Tigers. I mean, the film kind of follows an especially good season that they had.
Well, the Massillon Tigers came off of a 4-6 season in 1998. So I thought it'd be a great year to follow this team because it's very unusual to have a losing season in this town. And finally, I met with a couple kids that really sparked my interest. I had Danny Studer, who was the cradle-to-grave concept, the legacy, the third-generation player that wore number 55. You know, so I knew I had that. His father was a coach at the school. Then I had David. He was a partier and would take us out to the, you know, the scene and go dragging along the main strip in Massillon. And he was also, I thought, going to be the star of the team, the prima donna. So I followed him. That's two. And then when I met Ellery Moore, who flat out told me, you know, I was in jail for 15 months doing time. When I got out, I was stealing cars, doing drugs. And the football coaches got a hold of me and put me on the field, worked me out. And I have to honestly say, football saved my life. Hmm. Well, I knew right then and there that I had the narrative that I was looking for. The town had failed 3 years in a row to support a levy to keep the school doors open. So I found out as well that for 3 years running, they had lost to their arch rivals, the McKinley Bulldogs, the final game of the season that usually holds anywhere from 25 to 30,000 people. And I thought, is it possible that the win or loss of this football game determines the education of the city's children? Is that possible? So, but 3 years running, they failed the levy. 3 years running, they lost the McKinley Bulldogs. Where's the hope?
What people in this town might say or what they really feel is that that football team gives them hope. They were tired. They were upset. They were frustrated. They didn't want to vote for the levy because what hope did they have? We were 4-6. You know what I mean? There's no happiness there. It's all anger.
You got some amazing shots inside the locker room during halftime. And
yeah.
One of the things that's really amazing in those is just how closely religion is tied up with football. I mean, how mm-hmm. do those two fit together in Massillon?
Well, you're asking a good person about that. My father's a minister, and he was a minister in Massillon. And one of the greatest obstacles he had was to overcome the religion of football and to try to get people in seats on Sunday mornings. Why can't I get people in the pews like we can get people in the bleachers? That's a reality there. Because it's such a religion, you know, it was tough for some of the organized religions, if you will, to compete. But you probably can draw some of your own conclusions from the film. I have a great scene that intercuts the Lord's Prayer with these kids, you know, getting pumped up to go out and fight this war on the field.
So it's time to take that anger out, right? Right. Time to take that anger out, okay? We play safe because we go hard, okay? Our Father,
Lord in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Thy kingdom come.
On earth as it is in heaven.
And then as soon as they break this prayer, you know, one of the kids said, you know, uses profanity and wants to go out and kill somebody, you know?
The season you profiled in your film is a season, there's a lot riding on this particular season. We touched on the school levy that clearly is mm-hmm. going to pass or fail, depending on whether the team can manage to beat the McKinley Bulldogs. In your film, they win. And, in fact, the levy passes.
Oh, now you ruined it for everyone.
Sorry. But what happens to Massillon in the years when the team doesn't win, when there's not a good season?
That doesn't happen. No, it does happen. And when it does happen, that's one of the sections of the film that I pulled out that I really was fascinated by. It was called the Hero and Goat Glory Days section of the film, and it kind of profiled some of the people that have graduated from Massillon and had hero status while they were there and moved on and done great things or not such great things, but yet are still considered legends in Massillon and can go into any bar and saddle up and get a beer, and their money's not good anywhere. I mean, they can't buy any, you know, anything because they're still, you know, they have legendary status. So they are still held up on a pedestal. And then there's the goats, the guys that missed that last-minute field goal in 1973, and they are God's honest truth, still not welcomed in many parts of that town. Yeah. So it seems obnoxious to speak that way, but you know, it's a bit of an exaggeration that they're not welcome anywhere, but yet they're still, you know, they walk down the street and people are like, oh, I remember back in 73 against, you know, the, you know, Alliance Aviators when we missed the, you know, it's true. It's, and, but the ones like Chris Spielman that graduated from Maslin, went on and was an All-American Ohio State, and then moved on to play for Detroit and for Buffalo, and then for a little bit for the Cleveland Browns. He's a legend, you know, and he goes back there, and you know, it's, they have major fanfare and big parades for him, you know, and it's a unique town because they focus so much on this, and anything that stems from it is held up in high esteem, and if it's not a part of it, then it's kind of looked down upon.
There is indeed much to cheer about, much to blow their horns about in Massillon, Ohio. For here, football is king, and everyone pays it homage in America's number one touchdown town.
Touchdown Massillon!
Kenneth Carlson's documentary about high school football in Massillon, Ohio is called Go Tigers. Hey, good luck to the Ravens and the 49ers this weekend. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strangchamps. I love you more than a paper touch. I love you more than shooting ducks. I love you more than a pool hall, but not as much as football. To the best of our knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by a lot of people who love football and a few who don't. Packer fan Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour with the help of Broncos fan Doug Gordon. Sarah Nix gives a shout-out to the Montreal Alouettes, that's the Canadian Football League, and fellow football agnostic Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is diehard Packer fan Steve Paulson. Our technical director, who roots for the Packers, the Steelers, and the Giants, in that order, is Kirill Owen.
Baby, I love you more than everything but football.
And our theme music mashup was produced by DJ Joe Hartke, who, of course, roots for the Pack.
PRI, Public Radio International.